For you all, some of us caught the news this week that Binyamin Netanyahu went to Entebbe, the 40th anniversary. It was on July 4th, which is the day it took place, the day of the bicentennials, in 1976. It didn't really reclaim the front pages because it happened in the middle of the night, but it was very much prominent news already on July 4th because of the time change. And then certainly the next day, all the newspapers have on the top of the page, Israel is able to invade Uganda and save their hostages. And under it is, oh, by the way, America has just celebrated its 200th anniversary and the bicentennial, etc. This is a very personal story, if not so personal, somewhat personal story for me, in that I'm named after Yonatan Netanyahu. Not necessarily. My name is Yonah. His name was Yonatan, even though in some of the recordings it records him as Yehonatan. I'm not sure why. I saw a picture of his matzeva. It's Yonatan on the matzeva. So I'm not sure where Yehonatan came from, but the Yonatan, my name is Yonah, named after somebody else, but anybody who knows me in my pre-rabbinate days knows me as Yoni, and that was connected to Yoni Netanyahu. Okay, so there are several issues to get to with regards to this. We could spend the entire hour or so talking about the idea of exchanging hostages and going after captives, etc. I don't want to spend the whole hour doing that. There's a couple of other things to discuss as well, but that is kind of the most prominent issue here. And that is, Israel, I grew up always being told that Israel has a policy that we don't negotiate with terrorists. That's the end of the story. So that policy did not exist. It did not happen here. It did exist before 1976, and this was the break. This was the change in that policy. If one goes in the book, The Prime Ministers, by the way, a lot of the... As I'm reading through and records the dialogue in this book, in the book Operation Thunderbolt by Saul David, as he records the conversation, I realize I've read this exact words before, and I realized it was a lot of the conversation in the cabinet meetings coming word for word out of the Prime Minister's. Just took this, there's a whole chapter here on this topic, which was expanded here in Operation Thunderbolt. So a couple of years before, when Golda Meir was the Prime Minister, so they... Russia had a policy that we're going to let a couple of Jews out here and there, but we're not going to let them go directly to Israel, and we're not going to let them fly out. They have to take a train out. So they took a train out. They went to Austria, and then from Austria they would then be able to Chorno, I think that's how you pronounce it. Yeah, and from Austria they would be able to hop and get a flight or wherever they wanted to go. But Israel hoped to Israel. If not, they were going to go to America or someplace else. So there are terrorists took over a train. They held the entire train hostage. They said that if you don't go through with our demands, which is to close this DP camp, we're going to start killing the hostages on board. And Austria gave in, and that was that. So Golda Meir flies to Europe. She goes to the European. I'm not sure. It's called the European Parliament, I'm not sure it was the European Union exactly. She flies to the European Parliament and gives them over the head, and that's source number one. She says, and then in a voice hard and rude, she had a whole speech. Abner says, I wrote a whole speech out for her. And she said, you all have my speech in front of you, so I don't have to read it to you, so you could read that in your spare time, but I want to tell you something else. And she starts lacing into them for giving into terrorist demand. And he says, European governments have no alternative but to decide what they're going to do. To each one that upholds the rule of law, I suggest there is but only one answer. No deals with terrorists. No truck with terrorism. Any government which strikes a deal with these killers does so at its own peril. What happened in Vienna is that the democratic government, the European government, came to an agreement with terrorists, and so doing it has brought shame upon itself, etc. And at the end it says, oh, what a victory for terrorism this is, and that you were willing to give in. She then flies out to meet the president of the prime minister of Austria, Krinsky, I think his name was.
Kreisky,
and who happened to be Jewish, and she gives him over the head, and she yells at him. He defends himself. She yells at him some more. He says at the end, "Okay, well, do you want to go to do our press conference together?" And she said no, and she escaped out the back door and didn't even appear with him on stage. And famously, when she got back to Israel, they said, "How'd your meeting with Kreisky go?" She said, "Well, I'll just sum it up as he didn't even offer me a cup of water. That's the famous line that Golda Meir had. Furthermore, that was 1973. Before that, 1972, with the hostages in the Munich Olympics, Israel refused to negotiate with terrorists. That was the official line. You don't negotiate with them. And that led to disaster. But there were some other reasons for that as well. Israel wanted to get involved. Germany wouldn't let them get involved, whatever. But the policy always had been that we're not going to negotiate. We turn to source number two, and this was very surprising, and I reached out and asked some people about this. I kind of just got shrugs. But they had a cabinet meeting when this happened, and Rabin said that if we're not able to refuse them by force, we have no moral right to abandon them. We must exchange them for terrorists held here in our jails in Israel. They're asking for something like 25 terrorists. That was the... they had the audacity to ask for 25 terrorists. That was considered a big chiddush. Now, they get 100 terrorists for a body. I mean, that's the going rate now for some reason. But he says, our negotiations will be in earnest, not a tactical ruse to gain time, and we will keep our side of any deal we strike. That was Rabin's statement. Perez gets up and says, I object, to which Rabin muttered to himself, I'm sure you do. Perez is the Minister of Defense at that time, and he's a little bit of a shaky Minister of Defense because I'm not sure if he's the only Minister of Defense, but he never actually served in the military. He was never a soldier. He was already past military age during the War for Independence. And even though he was the Minister of Defense, he was a political rival of Rabin. And Rabin was very nervous, and they weren't very close, him and Rabin, even though I guess they shared the peace prize several decades later. So Perez says, I object, and you see the tension as Rabin mutters to himself, I'm sure you do. And Perez says, we've never agreed to the past to free prisoners who have murdered innocent civilians. If we give in to the hijackers' demands and release terrorists, everyone will understand us, but no one will respect us. That was the line that Perez had. And Rabin yells at him and says, for God's sake, Shimon, our problem in this moment is not more of your heroic rhetoric. If you have a better proposal, let's hear it. What do you suggest? You know as well as I do that the relatives of the hostages are stalking us day and night. They are beside themselves with fear, clamoring for us to make an exchange, and for good reason. What do they say? That they need. They say that Israel freed... what do they say? They say that Israel freed terrorists. He goes on that apparently they have freed terrorists in exchange for bodies after the Yom Kippur War. So he says, how could they have done that if we're... And we're not going to free terrorists in exchange for... In exchange for people that are alive. That was Rabin's Shita. In the Prime Minister's, it spells out that Rabin, I think, commented to, I think to Yehuda Avner, he said, I made this decision a long time ago, that if I was ever confronted with this type of predicament, I was going to give in to the demands of the terrorists. And it's striking. I mean, I remember reading it a couple of years ago in the Prime Minister's, and then it comes very clear here. They're ready to do it. Not only ready to do it, Rabin got full unanimous cabinet approval to negotiate with the terrorists. They were 100% going to pretty much give in to whatever demands were going to be made of them. And even when he asked for a vote after this little dialogue he has with Perez, Perez raised his hand also. Perez said, I'm in. He said, fine, I don't have an alternative option. Perez is ready to negotiate as well. The story goes, he goes next door, and next door is waiting. He was not a member, he was already a cabinet member for a few years, but he was no longer anymore. Menachem Begin. And he says to Menachem Begin, you know, this is what we're planning on doing. Menachem Begin says, I need to talk to my people. He comes back a few minutes later and says, we're fine. We're not going to object at all. We understand exactly what you're doing. I was shocked by this. The only people, it seems, that and in fact, it says in the book that the next day, as soon as the announcement went out that Israel was negotiating, the headlines in the newspaper were, Israel surrenders. Israel surrenders. The only person, Perez, was adamant against, and Perez is really the one who motivated the military option. Perez is minister of defense, and he said, "I have to come up with something in order to stop this from happening." That he's really the one who put it in motion. Here also, in Saul David's book, the other person that was very anti the negotiations was Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger got on the phone and called up Ambassador Simcha Dinitz, and said, I'm rather astonished by their decision, said Kissinger. We had no doubt, said Dinitz, they were going to slaughter them. We would have created in Israel tremendous national feeling. The pressure was up, so the government decided would negotiate the release. It was an argument that didn't cut any ice with Kissinger. You're going to have Israelis picked up all over the world now. And Dinitz seemed to agree. I have suggested to the Prime Minister, etc., and Kissinger continues to lace into him. And Kissinger said, you can't do this. And they're left. furthermore, as the story continues, that Friday night, it happened. They actually, the plane took off on Shabbos afternoon. July 4th was a Sunday, so they took off Shabbos afternoon, and it was that night. So the night before, Shimon Peres had some guests scheduled to be in his house. I'm not sure how. Brzezinski, the
yeah.
How do you pronounce it?
Yeah.
I'm not even going to try to do his first name.
Zbigniew.
So Zbigniew Brzezinski was the guest of Shimon Peres that Friday night, and Peres thought about canceling the appointment, and he said, "I can't listen. He's going to know something is up." So Peres is having this dinner, and he invited a few other people. Some people couldn't make it. Amata Gur, who was the joint chief of staff at the time, so he begged off. He actually had a death in his family, so he used that as an excuse to not go. But he had a reporter from Ma'ariv at the table, a left-wing newspaper in Israel. So Brezhnev says to... Am I saying it right?
Brzezinski.
Brezhnev is someone else. Brzezinski said... Right, I got it. So Brzezinski, in the middle of the meal, turns to the president and says, "I don't understand why you're negotiating with them. Why aren't you doing a military option? Why aren't you doing anything?" And Perez kind of like mutters something about, like, "Well, it's really far away," and then turns to the Ma'ariv reporter and says, like, you know, like, "What do you think?" or something. And he says, "Well, I understand the government's position." But after Brzezinski left, the Ma'ariv reporter turns to him and says, "I can't defend this. I don't understand what you guys are doing, just giving in and negotiating without trying anything." So it was, it's unclear to me where this tension is. I mean, the government of, the cabinet of Israel is totally unanimous, we're going to go ahead and do this. But there are arguments on the side. I tried getting a feel as to what was going on in the religious community at the time. Was there anything being said anti or for, etc. at the time? It's a little... I wasn't able to come up with much. So anyways, that's one of the mysteries that I have with regards to this issue. Yeah?
The New York Times article yesterday said that once they separated the Jews,
yeah,
that was when they decided to do the military operation.
No, I don't think they decided to do the military. My reading is they decided to do the military option when they had a military option. They really didn't think they had one, and if one goes through details, they didn't have much of a military option. There were a couple, they thought, in the first half of Minos, the first thought, they didn't know that whether Amin was in with them or not. Amin was the head of the president of Uganda, who had, a couple of days earlier, had been voted Ugandan president for life by his parliament unanimously, was a dictator, a very tough dictator, and they weren't sure where he was holding. Their thoughts were, if we could just neutralize the terrorists, so then Uganda would be okay with us and they'd support us leaving. That was several of the first plans that were put forward. There was somebody named Michael Cogot, or Cogot, C-O-G-O-T. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Cogot. He was French, who was kind of became the leader of the... He became the leader of the captives. He was one of the people that got an early release. He was able to confirm, and others as well were able to confirm, that the Ugandans were in on it with the terrorists. One of the things that proved, they knew very early, the captives knew, because when they got there, there was a meal for them. So this guy, however you pronounce his name, said to one of the people bringing in the food, like, "Wow, you're able to prepare all of this so quickly." So, "What are you talking about? We knew you were coming, a long time ago, a couple days ago." So this plan was already in place, and the Ugandan government was in on it from the very beginning, and that complicated matters immensely. And there really was no way for Israel to get back. One of the plans was, we're going to go and we're going to take over the entire country. we're gonna drop in our people, and we're going to secure Entebbe, and perhaps even secure, like, the country. It seems that's the words that they use, but at least the city. They figured we could drop a few thousand paratroopers, secure the city, and then we could fly people, take over the fuel reserves, and be able to go back. But the option that they ended up doing, of a smaller army flying in four planes, about 1,000 soldiers, that they really didn't know how they were going to get back until they were able to get the Kenyan government to give them a wink that they would be able to use the Kenyan airspace in order to get back. Was that they just didn't have the equipment to be able to do it. That was the thought, and that's probably the thought of the terrorists also, that we're safe here. Uganda is not, even though we just, from our perspective, oh, it's all out there. It can't be that far apart. Flying from Israel to Uganda is the equivalent of, I think, flying from Philadelphia to Phoenix. I mean, it's a pretty long flight. Part of what most of those countries are not so developed on don't actually have radar. So that was what helped the Israelis. But it was not a simple, just getting there, and more importantly, getting back was really the most difficult part of the military perspective. So let's just do a little bit of the halachos of Pidyon Shvuyim, meaning the idea of negotiating and perhaps even giving into their demands. So that sugya always starts with, there's a Mishnah in Maseches Gittin, Daf Mem Hei Amud Aleph, where it says, "Ein Podim Es Shvuyim Yeser Al Kedei Demein." That one is not to redeem captives more than their value. Why? Mifnei Tikkun HaOlam, because of for betterment of the world. So that's A. And B, v'im avrichin es ha-shvuyin, that you can't, the shvuyin, the captives aren't supposed to escape, mifnei tikkun olam, also for the betterment of the world, Rishim Gamliel omer mifnei takanas ha-shvuyin. Rishim Gamliel says no, because of the shvuyin that are there left behind, meaning if some people escape and others don't, so the ones that are left behind are going to be treated more harshly. As if anybody followed the prison break, last summer, right, from upstate New York, that prison, so there were there was lawsuits filed by the other prisoners because of the harsh treatment that was imposed upon them. So that is that's what the Mishnah says. This is the parak in Maseches Gittin deals with a list of takanos. What's the difference between a takana and a gezera? Meaning, gezera is, we don't put things on the fire on Shabbos, which you may rake the coals. That's a gezera. While other things are takanos. I once heard from Ayur Kefet, a very important distinction. He said, gezeros make you more from, takanos make you less from. Right? A takana is by death, like a, is kind of, I don't know, I say watering down, but for a purpose of better observance of mitzvahs, we kind of knock down mitzvahs. So there's clearly a mitzvah of pidyon shvuyin, but we're going to impose a takana and not let you do it. Meaning, in a way, it's less from, now for important value, etc. But that's interesting. So this is a takana.
Isn't a takana also sometimes within a certain period of time?
There might be a takana, okay, but this is a takana for a while. For instance, a takana, it's really a chayram, but a takana of not marrying more than one wife. So in theory, it's a mitzvah to marry more than one wife. But there's other problems with that, so therefore we're not going to go ahead and do that. So comes the Gemara and says, so ibaylu mahayim fnei tikkun olam mishum duchu de tziburahu odil mishum delo ligarbu v'laisi tfei. What does it mean tikkun olam? Is it because it would be very expensive for the people that would have to pay? Or maybe it's that they don't go ahead and capture more. So then it goes ahead and tells the story of Levi Bar Darga, who freed his daughter for a lot of money. So it implies that if you're willing to spend the money, that's okay. You don't have to worry about them going ahead and capturing more. So Bai responds and saying, who made Bar Darga the Gadol Hador? Maybe he wasn't right. Maybe he did the incorrect thing in going ahead and doing this. And a similar machlokas would then be by the Mavrichin and the Shvuyin. By the Mavrichin, what the purpose is for that. But the point of the Gemara is that we won't require people to free slaves and perhaps even prohibit. The Mishnah doesn't explicitly say prohibit. It says we don't do it. It doesn't necessarily prohibit, right? That's an interesting language there. I mean, it could be a permission to not do it, right? But we don't have to or don't free people that are captive for much more than their value. So the Gemara, a couple of dafim later, about 13 dafim later, tells the story of Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania, who stopped by a prison, and he met this young Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha. He wasn't yet Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha. At that point, he was known as Shimi, or something like that. And he was able to recognize that this Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha was going to be the next Gadol Hador, so he spent a lot of money in order to free Yishmael ben Elisha, and he went on to become Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, who sung about and Avim freed songs, amongst other places. So the Tosfos asks, in both places, why was he allowed to do this, right? Doesn't that violate the Mishnah on Daf Mem Hei Amud Aleph? So Tosfos gives several answers. There's two Tosfos in. They both actually give different answers. There is an interesting shir that I listened to this week from Rav Moshe Stav, who was the Kobi Hoffman's rabbi in Shoham, who discusses this this issue, and he points out something that I've also always thought for a long time, and that is when there's many answers amongst the Rishonim, when a question has 5, 6, 7, 8 answers, so that means that, that by definition means that the question is better than the answer. And if there was a clear answer, then you wouldn't need, it wouldn't be so much speculation. But Tosus here gives two answers and says, why are they allowed to do it? He says two. Kol shekein hacha de'ika katala, because here his life was in danger, inami mishum de muflag b'chachmahaya. That he was a muflag b'chachma, he was going to be considered a great Talmud Chacham, and therefore he's allowed to go free. So one of those two possible answers. So the impression that one, if one assumes like that second, the first answer of Tosos, that's because his life was in danger, so you get a totally different perspective on what that on what the Mishnah is talking about. Mm-hmm. It's not talking about hostage taking, and they take a plane and we threaten to kill them unless our demands are met. It's talking about people who professionally would take people and then try to make money off of them, like a slave trade. In fact, he's, in Michael Oren's book, when he goes through the connection of America and the Middle East for the last couple hundred years, so you see that that kind of stuff went on, that people would take people, demand a ransom, and then give them back when you paid the money. And there was like a market that people would... That would be involved here. So how do we paskin with regard to those answers? So in Shulchan Aruch it says, "Ein podin hashum yosem etei demem." You shouldn't do it. Mifnei tikan olam. Right? Quote from the Mishnah: "Shelo yuha oivim moshim asvam aleim lishavosam." So that the enemies won't try to get more. Aval adam yachol liftos etz atzma b'chol mashi yirtza. If a person has their own money, they're allowed to spend it. V'chein tamar chacham, or afilu enu tamar chacham, elashu tamar charif. Even or a tamar chacham, or even if he's not a big tamar chacham, but he's very sharp. V'efesher shiyah adam gadol. Maybe he will be great. Podemos sovadam merum. You're allowed to spend a lot of money in order to redeem them. That's the psak in Shulchan Aruch. So what is conspicuously absent from those exceptions?
Females.
Well, no, I wasn't thinking females. Life and death. Meaning that answer of Tosfos seems to be absent from this psak in the Shulchan Aruch. Right, just so why? So the Ramban quotes that Tosfos, and the Ramban says, "What are you talking about? If your life is in danger, then you're allowed to free him." By definition, the Mishnah is talking about a case where your life is in danger. Right, so it's a question of how to understand that Mishnah. So if one assumes that one's life is by definition in danger, so the Mishnah is saying, even so, we're not going to go ahead and redeem them. So that seems to be the Psak in Shulchan Aruch, that the life and death doesn't have an impact here. However, Rav Avadya Yosef has a lengthy essay on this topic. Even by his standards, lengthy. It's like 25, 30 pages, where he goes through the issues involved here. It's not a tshuva, it's rather he wrote it for a journal, but it was written after, I forgot to check if he was chief rabbi at the time, but it was written after, in response to the Entebbe Reit. He said, let's analyze some of the halachos that are involved with the Entebbe Reit. And he goes through 30 pages of discussing these issues. So in source number 6, he points out, the top lines, even though that they want more than their money, and we don't want to encourage them more than their value. They want more than their value. Now, how exactly do you judge that? They weren't really requesting money, they were requesting terrorists free, right? It's a little different. But mitam de lo ligru v'laisu, so we don't want to encourage them more. Mikol makom kishiyesh sakanas mamashis bedavar ke benidon didan, that if there is really a danger in a situation like this case, lo chashin al haitayma de dilma magru behu maisu tvei, we're not concerned for this anymore. And he goes on, and he thinks that that's the majority psak. The majority psak seems to be against Shulchan Aruch, that we pass in that way. And in the second underlined thing that I have there, umikaven dahavya rak takana v'kodem shetiknu kain v'vade shahayu podem biyos mechtei demehem. He says now we're not necessarily sure that that's what the psak should be, but keep in mind this is a takana. What was the halacha before the takana? The halacha before the takana is you have to spend whatever money you could in order to get the the guy free. So because Shnikta came Mavadi Shayu put him beyusim with the mayim, Amin the Bachai Gavna, Shehu Suffik in Tiknu Bakhlal, Ukma Adina. So therefore, if we're not sure that the Hakana actually imposes itself in a case where there is life in danger, so we push aside the Takana, or we don't apply the Takana, and we say you could go ahead and do whatever you need to in order to free the hostages. So Rav Avadi Yosef is giving a psak that you can go ahead and, you know, whatever money needs to be spent in order to redeem people, you can go ahead and do it. And the implication he gives in is that whatever their even though their demands were not money but were terrorists, so we can go ahead and do that. And that seems to be Rabbi Rav Stav in his tape also says that that's the mainstream psak, even though it seems to go against what it says in Shulchan Aruch. Okay, so if that's the case, now the very next few paragraphs that Rav Avadi Yosef has is well, how were they allowed to go and free them? And we'll do a little bit more of that in a few moments. But you're allowed to put your life in danger in order to save people from certain danger. That's the sugya. So the question is, wait a second. He just got through saying that you're allowed to spend money in order to redeem them. So why don't you do that? Just go ahead and redeem them. And don't put your soldiers in danger. Right? That's a question that's out there. So were they allowed to do that? So there is a New York Times article from a year later, you see, June 1st, 1977. It's actually not about the Entebbe thing. It's about, some people here might remember this, there was a big machlokasim going on between the Sofmer community and the Lubavitch community. And they were like real, real gangster stuff going on between these two communities. Highlighted in this article by what was the name of, I didn't put the author's name here, George Vesey. George Vesey, who I was a little shocked to see that title, because he's a sports writer. Yeah. So I think this is before he was a sports writer. But George Vesey, when I was growing up, every time my parents at that time got the New York Times, they don't anymore, but at that time, you open the sports section, George Vesey is the biggest sports writer in the New York Times.
He's also a sport.
Right. So George Vesey is the author of this article, and he describes this conflict started last July 4th with differences over the commando raid of the hijacked passengers at Entebbe Airport in Uganda. So he quotes Rav Schneerson, which we'll get to a little bit later. But the last line that I have here is, Satmar officials charged that Israel had no right to risk the lives of soldiers to save passengers. This was a secular decision not covered in Jewish guidelines. That's what Safarov held. Safarov wasn't alone. Go to the back of the page. Source number 8 is from the Sefer Rivos Ephraim. Now, the Rivos Ephraim Greenblatt, I think we quoted him a couple of weeks ago, with regards to something else. So, Rav Ephraim, I've come across this, if not for Rabbi Josh Flug, who put out a few sources on this. But in the back of his Chelek Ches, he just has a couple of letters that were out there. He collects them. I'm not sure what they have to do with each other. But one of the letters is a letter that Rav Shach put out. And Rav Shach wrote that everybody is all excited about this raid in Entebbe and how they were successful, and it's really amazing. But if you look at the part that I underlined, halacha machria hisnagus b'shas sakana, that the halacha tells us how to act in times of sakana. V'imlefi hadin ein lasos hadavar, and if according to halacha you're not supposed to go ahead and do something, af shelabasof hitzliach, even though at the end you were successful, ein hu matzdik es hamaisa, we don't celebrate the action that you did. And he says, you're not allowed to walk under a stumbling wall, a shaky wall. So let's say you do walk under a stumbling wall and you end up surviving on the other side. So you're going to celebrate that you survived walking through the stumbling wall you shouldn't have done in the first place. So, and I'd be interested to know if this was mainstream Haredi thought at the time, that they, at least Rav Shach and the Sakharov, those are in the mid-70s, those are some two heavy hitters at the time, were saying that this wasn't an appropriate action that should have been taken. You should have negotiated, and you shouldn't have put the soldiers' lives in peril. Now, he records here in Operation Thunderbolt that they had expected casualties of, they thought that 20 soldiers were going to die. That's what their expectation was, and they thought something like 20 hostages were going to die. That was their assumptions going in. Rabin, and in hindsight, Rabin was the one who didn't want to do this, but ultimately Rabin signed on, and after he signed on, he wrote a resignation. He had it. No, Rabin. Rabin went to his aide and said, "I need you." Maybe it was Ehud Avner actually, but it's not. I don't think it's in the Prime Minister's. It's in this book. He said, "I need you to write up my resignation letter, because if this fails, it needs to be prepared. I'm gonna be on the hook for it, and probably the rest of the cabinet will also." And before they said, "What's going to be considered a success? What's going to be considered a failure?" And they assumed if less than 20 soldiers die and less than a quarter of the captives die, we'll consider it a success. That was the assumption going, and that's part of what you got to deal with. When they did Operation Opera, right, when they bombed the nuclear reactor in Iraq, the assumption was that not all the planes were going to get back. They had one who became the astronaut and died in space,
Ilan Ramon.
He flew that mission. He was the last plane. The last plane is the most dangerous plane, and the reason he was the last plane is because he was the only one that wasn't married. And it was just what's going to be. And that was the assumption going in. So comes a couple of poskim saying, so then you shouldn't have done it. You should have done whatever it takes to free these captives. So what then is the?
So wait, they're saying it's okay to negotiate, but not to use force.
Right.
Versus they're not saying you shouldn't have done anything.
They're going along with the psak that despite Shulchan Aruch not listing it, we assume that you are allowed to negotiate and we shouldn't use force. Now, Rabbi Stav points out that the Sakhma Rav is consistent. The Sakhma Rav thinks that there shouldn't be a state in the first place because it's going to cost Jews' lives. Right? So this is just a continuation of that problem. So he's consistent. the other side is difficult. How does one legitimize it? So there's a couple of approaches on how to say that, despite the fact that there's going to be a risk involved, that one should go ahead and take part in this activity. So I already see we're starting to run low on time. So let's we'll try to. So source number 9 is Ravad Yosef. Ravad Yosef, he invokes, by the way, what was haunting, and you could tell through the book what was haunting them the whole time was a destruction of a girls' school in Mahalot. There was a terrorist takeover, a hostage crisis in Mahalot. The commandos tried going in, and it was a failure. They were too slow, and end up being, I think, a lot of people died in that incident. And you see the whole time, they whenever they're questioning what's going to go on, they say, we're going to have another Mahalot. That's what they keep referring to. On the other hand, they've had some successful takeovers. There was an airline that went to Ben-Gurion Airport that Ehud Barak was in charge. And Ehud Barak, and they went in, they stormed the airplane, and they knocked out the terrorists. They did lose some hostages. There were some hostages that got killed, but that was considered a successful attack. In fact, in this book, there is a picture of Ehud. There's a famous picture. I saw it a few times after that. There's a picture of Ehud Barak standing on the wing, holding his rifle with a dead terrorist at his feet, and the people are coming off. So there were some successes and there were some not successes, and it was unclear what's going to be. So why is this allowed? So Rav Avadya Yosef quotes from the Minchas Chinuch, a very important shita that appears that the Minchas Chinuch has, and he says that we have a couple of mitzvot that are yehoreg v'al yavar, that one is required to give up your life rather than to violate that prohibition. War is not one of them. However, war, by definition, we have something called Milchemes Mitzvah. That concept exists. War, by definition, is going to have casualties. So if we are commanded in war, by definition, the calculus of casualty, that there's going to be a casualty and therefore we shouldn't do it, that calculus goes out the window. You end up supporting yourself based on what's best for our country, what's best for the Jewish people. That becomes the calculus rather than each individual. So Rav Avadya Yosef quotes that Pinchas Chinuch. Rav Shechter in source number 10 tells the story, the story is known, that Rav Huttner was taken. From what I could tell, I'm a little vague on this, that was the very first hijacking was in 1970. They hijacked the Palestinians hijacked 4 planes and then a fifth a couple days later, took them to Jordan, right, and to some abandoned airfield in the middle of nowhere. Rav Yitzchak Huttner was famously on that plane. They didn't reveal it. In fact, I saw that when the New York Times published the list of hostages, they listed his name as Yitzchak Hunter. on purpose. Isaac Hunter, because it would have gotten out that he was on board, so then, you know, the price is then going to go up significantly. So they, it's pretty interesting. So there was a movement in Chaim Berlin to raise the millions of dollars necessary to redeem him. And they went, and some said, yeah, he's a muflad b'chachma, right? He's qualified on the Shulchan Aruch to at least save him. And he had some family members as well. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky Paskin, not. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, you're not allowed to do that because they are in a state of war. And in a state of war, anything that's going to aid the other side is not permitted to be done. That was Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky had that side. Now, full disclosure is, other than in Rav Shechter Sefer, I've never seen this story anywhere else. So I asked Jonathan Rosenblum about it. He did the biography on Rav Scherer, who would have been involved in such a thing. He didn't really recall it. But at least the psak is out there. I mean, at least Rav Shechter holds that way. I mean, it's an ace tsar, it's an ace milchama, and therefore the calculus of each and every individual is it falls away and ends up being a psak of okay, what's better for our for the war effort. The war effort then takes control. There is a sefer called the Shal Shuv Chavus Bin Yamin, written by Rav Rav Shol Yisraeli, who was a dayan for the Rabbanut, the Rosh Hashiva of Merkaz Harav. He has a couple of tshuvas having to do with this issue. He also, I think, is either the founder or was the Av Beis Din of Eretz Chemda, where he has another aspect, or he says, he points out that there is another Gemara about captives, and that is a Gemara in Ksuvus, where it says that a husband is permitted to redeem his wife for more money. I mean, just as a person is allowed to redeem themselves, a husband is allowed to redeem their wife. So why is that? So he suggests that because the husband is responsible for her. And when you have a case of the Israeli army, or the Israeli government saying, we take achrayas for you, you are under our protection, so then you have a responsibility to get him out, even though it might be at, even though it might come out of danger. That is, so those are couple of possibilities that are out there. Generally, the thought is, and Rav Stav spoke about this as well, and he speaks about it at length in another topic, he felt that it left the realm of psak and entered into the realm of what's better for the Jewish people. You know, and you see Simcha Dinitz, when he said to Kissinger, he says, imagine if they would have, all of a sudden they would have died. And we've shown that we don't care about them. And that is, by the way, the American policy, I think, Adayoma says, that we don't negotiate with terrorists unless they happen to be Hamas or they happen to be somebody like that. Right? We don't deal with Iran. Right? We don't deal with terrorists. And but you also then see that there are people that languish in these places for years and years, and America just shrugs their shoulders and makes statements of, we won't rest until these people are brought back, and then go out and play golf. Right? That's the kind of stuff that one sees. So it's a fine line about how to deal with this. But perhaps there is an issue here. Okay, so that's, I said I wasn't going to spend the whole time talking about redeeming captives, and then we just spent too long talking about redeeming captives. But I want to talk about two other issues. Number one is that the quote that the Lubavitcher Rebbe had at the time, it was quoted in the New York Times article as saying, Rav Schneerson referred to it as a miracle. After all, he said, miracles are not only things that happened long ago. We're the same people as when the Sea of the Reeds parted. I mean, it was a miracle. It's plain and simple that you're going to send people to any place. Everything's going to work. You know, not everything worked exactly perfectly, but it worked pretty perfectly. That was an ace. And in fact, he published a couple of questions regarding this. Well, the last question was, and you go back to that place, do you make the bracha of Sha'as and Nisim v'makom hazeh? If you were saved, do you go back and so it's somewhat of a, although it came true this week that captives went back, and there were members that were there that went back this week with Netanyahu and were part of that ceremony. So that question was asked, and Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he says, yes. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva that he wrote, it's entitled to Avreichim Mimir, and there's two issues that there. So the second one is the hatzalah that took place by the chayalim that are in Shomrei Torah. So does that impact it at all? And he said, absolutely doesn't. Does it make a difference whether they were saved by some miraculous supernatural occurrence, or people that were saved, or they were saved by, you know, non-religious soldiers. Who, you know, that doesn't make a difference. They were saved, and therefore one has to recognize it as a miracle. And one can see the last line. It says, "V'darkei Hashem yisparach she'asa neis ayidei poshim ne'alamu mimenu." Right? That sometimes Hashem does miracles by those that are, you know, those that are that violate halacha. V'asul l'shum adam lishakim b'kushas v'al kadosh bach. When it's prohibited to raise those questions against Hashem, el tam tiyei mashem k'mefurash b'Torah. Rather, be simple in your ways of understanding the ways of the Kadosh Baruch. Okay, so that is it seems to pass that yes, you would perform a bracha when you got there. I don't know if any of them did this week, but that is the psak that Rav Moshe has in Negros Moshe. But perhaps the most meaningful thing is that, remember, I'm sure people, the mood was not very good in Israel. This is 2-3 years after the Yom Kippur War. Six-day war had come and gone, and it was nerve-wracking. I mean, there are 3 or 4 planes being hijacked a month at this time. Not all Israel-related, but a lot of Israel-related. This is the time of the oil embargo. This is the time of Gerald Ford's reassessment. These were difficult times going on for the people of Israel.
It's also 3-4 years after Munich.
Right. After this was over, Begin made a speech. Begin made a point of thanking Yitzhak Rabin, and he says, even though we all had shared a part in this decision, upon your shoulders rests an extra morsel of responsibility, and who can measure the weight of that morsel? That was what Menachem Begin said. But then he goes on and makes the analogy between the German-sanctioned Selectia and Entebbe, and the more infamous action of Dr. Mengele at Auschwitz. I mean, it wasn't exactly the same, but he made that comparison, and you see about 4 lines before the break, was it's a different page, but we declare all to hear, never again. Our generation has taken a solemn oath consecrating the blood of our slain mothers, our butchered fathers, our asphyxiated babies, and our fallen brave. Never again will the blood of the Jew be shed, persecuted, or it's cut off. I put it here. Or humiliated, or threatened, or abducted, or in any way endangered simply because he or she is a Jew, then Israel would marshal all its strength to come to their aid and bring them to the safe haven of our homeland. This was the message of Entebbe. The thunderous applause went on, and for that day at least, Israel's Jews were unified. So that very much, as soon as I read that, that echoed to me back to the statement that the Rav made in his Kol Dodid Ufeik. He talks about the 6 knocks that are represented by the birth of the modern state of Israel, and he says, the 5th knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important of all. For the first time in the history of our exile, divine providence has surprised our enemies with the sensational discovery that Jewish blood is not free for the taking. It's not hefker. If anti-Semites wish to describe this phenomenon as an eye for an eye, so be it. And by the way, he goes on for a page, which I don't know if would be so, which would probably be destroyed in the press nowadays if you would say such a thing. He goes on to say that all these people that do things to us, and he lists off leaders by name, he said, and this is in the 50s, he says, if we could take him out, we should take him out. And in fact, that was part of the deal with Kenya, that Kenya said, if you want to land here, then please take out those MiGs, those